We are now starting the second part of this afternoon's lectures and talks with Galia Baror and Zvi Efrat. Communal by commune, the perpetually negotiable dwelling is the title both of their talk today and of their installation here at Wohnungsfrage exhibition. You will most likely have visited the exhibition and seen this installation that portrays Kibbutz Yagur in a very broad and still also very unconventional way, as we see both historical and contemporary footage from and about the kibbutz. We see the interrelation of the building process, the planning process, and the everyday life. We see how the community establishes itself by way of building and by way of actually defining its architectural setting. And we think that the whole relation between collectivism and individuality, between architectural planning and the life, the social life in space, is very well retraceable here in a very precise way in this example of Kibbutz Yagur. Galia Baror and Zvi Efrat will give us a talk today in two parts. First, Galia will talk, and then Zvi, and then we will have time to address questions from the audience and discuss the issues raised. Galia is author and curator. She is a member of the kibbutz, Ein Harod, where she is the director of the Museum of Art, called the Mishkan Museum of Art. She's an author and curator, as I said, and the fantastic experience of actually having someone exhibiting and talking about a historical issue as an historian, but at the same time being also a dweller right in the kibbutz, is actually a coincidence that makes this the whole way that the issue is being addressed, I think, still much more credible and also much more concrete. And this is what we talked about when we said one-to-one earlier and over again. And Zvi Efrat is an architect and artist and architectural historian. He's an architect with the firm Efrat Kowalski in Tel Aviv. He's a professor at Bezalel University there. And you all know him probably from his writings and his exhibitions. I would like to welcome together with you Galia Baror and Zvi Efrat.
I really hope that you visited the exhibition, small exhibition on wooden wall downstairs, and in the short time we have, I would like to point one issue only, and it is the awareness of architecture evident in this small community. And of course, this small community, as it is pictured by us in the exhibition, and this sounds a little bit funny, it's too good to be true. And one asks, what is the context, and what can we learn from it? One of the speakers in the discussions, assembly discussions that we reenacted in the show and we recorded, links between the architectural layout of the kibbutz and the social specific agenda of the kibbutz. And that also seems funny because small communities are not expected to formulate articulated agenda. And indeed, this is a case that where social agenda, social vision, and architectural vision went hand in hand, because this kibbutz Yagur belonged to a kibbutz movement that proposed a new way of living. It was the village city, the town-village kibbutz, And it is an idea of living in full equality, developing industry as well as agriculture and Gemeinschaft based on solidarity as well as Gesellschaft, society based on social contract. These are notions are based on Ferdinand Tönnies' well-known book about Gemeinschaft und Gesellschaft, but it has today other interpretation. And also they emphasized culture and education. Since the notion of ideology is not so much favored today, I would like to put it this way, that through ideology and ethos and social practice, they grasped the plot of the time, and they attempted to confront its challenges. And the village town kibbutz movement, I would say a few words about it. It started in the early 20s, and the name is HaKibbutz HaMeuchad, the United Kibbutz, because it envisioned a new form of living, rejecting the two existing forms, the village, which was seen as exploited, exploited and depleted, and the town seen as alienated and polluted. Most of the members fled from Eastern Europe after the blow of big attacks on Jews in 1919, the Petliura pogroms, and they arrived with practically nothing, no possession, but with the belief that the women and men are able to make a change for a better society. The articulation of the village kibbutz idea was expressed in writing in a memorandum sent in 1923 to the World Zionist Organization Settling Institution, and I will read to you the words. Our goal is to live the life of a large society, a working society, which overcomes the artificial differentiation harmful in both its human and its national economic aspects, keeping urban work and rural work separate. Our aspiration is a society that unites physical and mental work within itself. They believed that throughout the country, many independent settlements such as these would be established and would conduct free reciprocal relations within their own frameworks, not under the authority of party or state, but by dint of a social and economic system based on equality and sharing. The village town movement provided tools. Tools are very important. That's how they phrased it. What does it mean, tools? Tools, for example, was a center of architecture for planning and for constructing the kibbutzim of the same orientation. Tools was also founding an endowment fund. Endowment fund that could finance these initiatives. And these tools were crucially important for the movement because they had to fight for the realization of their vision, because the authority objected the idea of a village city, village town, kibbutz. Also their conventional ideas were those of a rural and agrarian model in peripheral areas out of cities. Yitzhak Tabenkin, who was one of the authors of the village town idea and also one of the fierce critics of the pure village conception, related to this as follows. They had sanctified a certain ideal of a village on the premise that this is it, how it has been since the six days of the creation, by nature. And you want to introduce a factory into a village? A factory's place, as everyone knows, is only in a town. We should know then that the city and the village are not a natural form of human settlement. They are transient historical forms, which to a large extent are opposed to the natural needs of their populations. Human history did not begin from them and is not bound to them. And also it was said, we are not going to stop living our lives and doing what we do just because someone does not like the way we live. In the worst case, we will have to do it ourselves. Now, it's interesting to mention that the allurement to the role of architecture was not evident in all kibbutz movements, and not all kibbutz movement articulated or formulated their social, clear social idea. Yagur became a center for the village-town movement building initiatives, and its location near the Technion in Haifa played an important role. The movement encouraged members to study professions of building, architecture, engineering, and such, constructors, and the students who came from remote kibbutzim in the south, in desert or the north, they formed a community who lodged in the resident houses of Yagur. All Yagur professionals were trained in that frame provided by the movement, and the movement also founded building an enterprise near the kibbutz, a reservoir of construction materials, and a center for the builders. At the last data discussion, I would first say that Yagur started in 1923, was founded. It is still a kibbutz, not privatized. But I may say that the founder passed on in Yagur to the first and second generation some skills and practice of building, but the ethos and the agenda of the village city, which was so much planted, so much important to the founders, was gradually forgotten. Ideology. Who cares for ideology? At the last data discussion recorded in the show here, it is from August 2015, the architect who is a kibbutz born, and he's also a son of an architect who is a kibbutz born in Yagur. He responds to questions that the members ask him following his presentation of the new residential unit to be built in 2016. And they ask him why he selected shingled roof, and not flat roof. And if you have seen the show, you know that most of the residential buildings in Yagur have flat roofs, which is not surprising. These are the characteristic of town, and this is a village town, kibbutz. And he answers, why shingled roof? Because this is characteristic of a rural and a kibbutz settlement. So it seems that instead of the urban discourse of planning the kibbutz, which was so crucial to the founders, we see now these sweeping suburb conceptions and, of course, arbitrary policies. And I shall end by mentioning or noting, we don't have time to deal with it, that some interesting ideas are developing now in urban kibbutzim that are integrated in cities, in towns, especially in deprived town.
Neighborhoods, yeah. Maybe in deprived neighborhoods.
Yeah, no, in towns, like On the periphery, Afula and Kiryat Shmona and others. Actually, this is a kind of movement, but there are different initiatives. It started the late 70s, but now there is a revival. And there are interesting options opened for urban kibbutzim. They deal with education, culture, and society in these places. Some are planning separate neighborhood for the kibbutz, and some, I think, which are more interesting, are settling in existing buildings deliberately, wishing to be part of the community where there are drugs and the harsh conditions, and they work there. I think this is, and there are many of them. It isn't a case of esoteric small groups. And it seems, I will end by saying that it seems that only with the reactivization of social agenda, cultural agenda, architects may collaborate hand in hand to propose meaningful, inspiring architecture. And only a strong social movement has a chance to confront what we see today economically, politically, and culturally.
Thank you. Well, surprisingly, I would say more or less the same thing as Galia, but from an outsider position. Basically, I will make here an oversimplified argument, that is that collective or communal models accelerate both professional architectural activity and amateur architectural activism. That's basically what I want to say, and I'll show how it looks. Yagur. Well, I find the kibbutz, this most radical yet also benign and still sustainable form of collective life known to us, an intriguing case study, mainly because it is an extreme example of architectural routine or architectural mise-en-scène, whereby all the players, professionals, amateurs, mediators, builders, and dwellers, constantly act out their roles as a matter of habit, of habitus, and often change roles and play more than one role in this mutual and not entirely futile experiment in designing equality. This is how it may look. These are some of these, I'll show some images of communal facilities, communal buildings, in a commune, in a kibbutz. They're rather unusual because, as you will see, they have a very important performative, almost ritualistic aspect to them, and they have, of course, to contain the entire community. In this case here, the community of veteran members receive newcomers, new immigrants, at the on these balconies of the dining room in En Harod, the Galez kibbutz. Or another case in an adjacent kibbutz.
My uncle is coming from Germany, from Berlin.
Okay.
He's 14 years old.
In this image, of the former, okay. It's, of course, beautiful modernist architecture. It's not Galia, it's simply the urban and the rural, or the signifier of the urban, the flat roofs, and it's, I think that is also here kind of a blatant use of modern architecture, of modernist architecture, but of course not as a style, it's not an international style, but it's perhaps what in the former lecture could be called, it's the rational. It represents the rational, the pragmatic and most flexible way to accommodate the commune's life. Some examples of this architecture against the background of the Carmel Mountain. This is Yagur, our case study here. This as well. This is Galez Museum in En Harod. And this is one of my favorite buildings designed by a woman architect, one of a very few women architects. It's a theater, right? A commune is almost by definition a design, an artifice, a theater. And architecture here is essential and instrumental as a primary medium to actually make, construct, but also represent the social, political, and cultural idiosyncrasy of the community. Why is architecture so pertinent? Because there is a lot of invention and deconstruction and reconstruction going on here. After all, there are no typological precedents for this kind of community that Galia described of rural, urban, and no natural evolution to rely upon. So we see that architecture, of course, is not only the design of the built facilities, but also the outline, the planning, the planning schemes. And here we see really excessive attempts to define what would be this new space of the commune. Here we see a kibbutz architect, Bickels, who's trying to define the relationship between the community and the surrounding landscape. Other attempts to define the relationship between the built objects, or the, in this case, the dwellings, and space. Just to give you an idea, just to get a sense of these architectural experiments, the main point would be, and this is really the intriguing novelty for us architects, is that it is truly a space, it is truly a unified space, a Gesamtkunstwerk, if you will, where the entire cycle of life or live work, indeed, is unified and not parcelized, not divided. There is zoning. Actually, there are regions, there are zones, the productive zones or the industrial or agrarian zones, and then the living zone, but there's no parcellation. And this is really, to my mind, almost unprecedented for an entire community, an entire settlement, that there is no subdivision of lots. It may look like that. Of course, it looks very organic, but it's, again, it's a total design. It's a total artifice. It's a work of architecture. Nothing, and this is my point, nothing in a commune could be done without architects or different kinds of architects. Architects, urbanists indeed, landscape architects, gardeners, and so on. So what we see here is this kind of flowing, undivided space, whereby definitely the structural or the structuring element, of course, is the pathway system and the vegetation. So all this figure-ground relationship that we're used to in architecture relative to its terrain is reversed here, and buildings would be, I would say, secondary to the design of the environment or of the landscape. Here it's even clearer. We see how these buildings, here we're dealing with the area of housing, for dwelling in the kibbutz, they're really floating in space without lots, without any demarcation of me and my neighbor. In fact, one may argue that the entire dialectics of private and public is challenged here, because everything is, since everything is really communal, everything is common, there are only various degrees of communality or communality, but not really, but nothing really is private. This is a beautiful image that I like, because oftentimes landscape architects would be, or gardeners as they are called in the kibbutz, would be the most significant planners. They would be sometimes come even before architects. So every plant is designed, or considered, and so on. The composition of the gardening comes before anything else, and then we see sort of in the background the buildings floating in this very sensual space. So a lot of these diagrams trying to figure out the zoning, the urbanism of such a community. So a new space has to be invented, the rules of the game must be set, dwelling standards must be negotiated, the very fundamental notions of household, the family, privacy and publicity are at stake here. Or in fact, basically the entire relationship between family, labor and property. No private ownership at all. Land has no value as real estate since it is not parceled, as I mentioned. It belongs to all and has no inner boundaries. The communal is the common and vice versa. Here we see the plan or the master plan of Yagur by Richard Kaufman. And in fact, this is mid-20s plan. Kaufman comes from his Munich education as a Gartenstadt architect under Theodor Fischer, and he brings to the rural what he knows, which is a garden city scheme, basically urban scheme to the rural. So I would treat this as a transitional plan. It's still not decided how communal this architect can go. This is almost a neoclassical plan, or at least in part. We see this hierarchy and axis of symmetry, not what we've seen, what we will see later as a totally free, open plan of the kibbutz. So professional theorists and practitioners of space making, planners, urbanists, architects, landscape architects, engineers are always in need. And quite remarkably, in this rather small community of Yagur, they have utilized or corresponded with such renowned architects as Richard Kaufman that I just mentioned, Erich Mendelssohn, which was a surprise for us. It was just a discovery while we were digging in the archives. We discovered Mendelssohn the Rural. I'll show it in a second. Or Bickers that I talked about before. So this is Richard Kaufman doing housing in the kibbutz and other facilities. This is a dining hall of the kibbutz by Joseph Eidelman, a kibbutz member. A member of Yagur. This is Mendelssohn. The rule is quite a rare, witnessing quite a rare finding of these two buildings. Actually, the one on the left, is a kind of a vocational school to train the young people of the kibbutz with certain Fachhochschule. With certain traits. And the one on the right is actually the dormitory for these students. This is how it looks some years later. Mendelssohn is part already embedded in a kibbutz. Some beautiful sketches by Bickels trying to invent new typologies of cultural buildings. So this would be the facade with the arcades on the sides with these two wings. And this is the inside of this kind of hollow theater inside the building. This is another type by another great architect who's a Bauhaus graduate and a student of Hannes Meyer, Aryeh Sharon, who later became the planner of the entire master plan of the State of Israel in 1950, but here in the early 30s, he's designing, he's proposing a dining hall. Again, it's a typology that has to be architecturally figured out. And this is his it's quite amazing proposal. Okay. But as much as professionals are in need to design the communal layout and the collective facilities, there is an even greater need for the community itself to develop its own architectural skills. One could say that architecture is an essential component of the individual and collective building of the community. If you want to live in a commune, you will have to develop your own spatial instincts and your architectural savoir-faire. So, unfortunately, these are the best images that we could find for this. So just the community, the people of the community of all ages, men and women participating in this building process. We couldn't find images of people actually designing. So this is the best I can show you here. But this is real. As we learned from the archival research, the commune of Yagur has developed elaborate participatory discourse and actual building habits through regular general assembly meetings, internal planning and building committees, and training of its own local architects, gardeners, and artists and builders, as Galia already mentioned. And in our installation, the sound installation, one of the tables, we reenacted protocols of such meetings, as you mentioned, and there we can find debates on issues of communal dwelling along several decades. Now, the point is that we could find really what could be for us tedious debates over a bathroom or a balcony, but for them, of course, it would be extremely critical to the very definitions of privacy and collectivity, about the size of rooms, which, of course, is anyway very minimal. It could be 33 already is a large space, to become a 39. 39 was the Yoshi's kind of Tokyo number. So 39, the kibbutz, is already a luxury. And, of course, later on, there are more pertinent issues like the sleepover of the children with the parents, because initially, of course, the whole point is that the children are not with the parents, and they're living in a children's society. But later on, during the 70s or 80s, depends where, these debates end up with most of these communes bringing the kids back home, and which, of course, has a lot of implications on the structure and architecture of the dwelling. Okay, to conclude, I would like to say this. If we are to take seriously this experiment, this I would say radical experiment, we can, at least for a moment, gain back some, again, for a moment, I mean, because we're all skeptics, of course, our trust in the usefulness, in the possible or probable usefulness of architecture, as well as in the effectiveness of communal participation. True. I have to do something for the... Okay. Sorry. True. Communes or collectives tend to be exclusive, exclusionary, self-centered, and in their own austere way also self-indulgent, and therefore they become rather homogeneous socially, ethnically, and politically. And perhaps because they are above all intellectual constructs, and as such intuitively almost search for ideological common ground. But perhaps this is precisely the challenge of such collectives today in Yagur or in Berlin, to figure out and rearticulate their relations with the outside, their interface with the city, on a much larger scale than these now experiments that you describe, the contract with the welfare state. Then they may open up to a diversity of possible forms of collectivity, and not just one form, including perhaps even hipster culture. The project of designing equality, if it is to survive, cannot anymore be an equalizer, but on the contrary, a framework to debate political difference and negotiate conflicting interests. Thank you.
Thank you both for this insight, for this very precise talk on the kibbutz and its context. And before we ask the audience, and we have to be quick now because I think we're a little bit over time here, I would like to make one question to both of you, because looking at the Mendelssohn building, the way it was historically when you showed the picture, it's a perfect modernist building. And then we see in the exhibition, of course, that it underwent so many changes that today it's hardly recognizable as a Mendelssohn building. So the architect in us, of course, even if we are not from the field of conservationists, still feels something has been also lost. Now, if we look at change as something not per se positive or negative, but as something necessary, so the kibbutz of 22 cannot be the kibbutz of today, and we see architecture as such an important and central issue in the constitution of social life, as you described it now, then we should also maybe see the regression in certain architectural elements as a possible signifier for some other social changes that are regressive, perhaps. This is a question, and my question to you would be, can we look at the development of the kibbutzim from then to today as something that, by introducing maybe elements also of more familiar and private life within the idea of collectivism, as you mentioned, with the children not being anymore in the children's house now, but being with their parents again, can these elements also constitute something like a positive change? And could we even look at the architectural change of this author architecture into something more vernacular as something positive then, and maybe go beyond this heroic idea of the 20s?
Me? Okay. First, with Mendelssohn, I can't not react to this. It's a funny case, and it's, for me, it was really a shock to see. And I'm not a purist.
The other building remained the same. There are two buildings of his, and one, the dormitory, is exactly as it was.
Yeah, for you it's the same, but for us, I guess it's far from the same.
No.
It's a horrible. It was appropriated or reused as now as a housing, so it's now. I'm glad that you feel that it's the same. You see, this is already it's a good sign, but certainly this discovery, of course, will lead to do something about these precious objects. But it's really unimportant. It's totally unimportant.
No, but just an aside.
A kibbutz has a right to exist only if it's flexible enough to adjust itself, as it does internally, but also to adjust itself to the changing social political context. And if it doesn't want to remain kind of a gated community, of course it has to undergo certain changes. The problem right now in Israel is that this process happens too fast, and with this beautiful dialectics of city, or negative dialectics of not a city nor a village, it becomes a suburb. And this is really disconcerting. So it could be anything but, for me, but a suburb. Now, what could it be? I think that we begin to see now very interesting smaller formations, even within kibbutzim or outside them, of smaller groups, It could be several families, or it could be even a young generation in the kibbutz redefining, you know, the protocol. And we see a much looser, a much more interesting relation to architecture, to the environment, to the fellow communes, to the urban. People start to go out and work. They start to lease the beautiful buildings, because the thing is that a lot of these, the excess of communal buildings is largely unused today. So we see a lot of empty buildings. So they begin now to lease it to all these startup companies. And so we begin to see this kind of dirty mixes, which I find much more viable and for me also interesting. So this would be a possible future, if any, for it.
And would this be possible within the framework of ideology? Because not just as a post-ideological kind of vernacular or eclecticism, but as something that is still within the framework of an ideology of the kibbutz. I mean, how many elements of, let's say, ownership or property are reintroduced into this basically collective model then in a realistic framework today? Is it still, can we talk about collectivism still if there are all these elements that are regressive?
Yes, because principally the production mm-hmm. errors stay common. So the property actually is shared. But the main thing is it still relevant? And if, for example, we see now a revival of kibbutzim because many young people are coming and staying there. And for myself, it is not so interesting if these kibbutzim are, there is a kind of bloom again, if people only do care for the education of their kids and live ecologically nicely and have a community to have festivals together and all that, because I think that you must also be responsible for what is around you. And the empowerment of the kibbutz always, and we as individuals, I think it's the same, only when we contribute, when we take responsibility, we live meaningful life. And it's the same with the kibbutz. And this is now, I'm not sure what will become. There are options, there is a potential, but we are going to see. If it is just a petit bourgeois place, you know, then for myself it is not a place I would like to live in, even if they share the whatever and they have a very nice life, because something is missing there.
You would describe it as a vital place today. It is a vital place.
It is a place that is now taking a new shape, mm-hmm. and nobody knows yet what kind of shape it will take. The whole country is in a big trouble, especially, I would say, thinking anew and finding new ways to solve conflicts and suggest new ways of thinking. And so maybe artists should be introduced there, and they will project new ideas.
So I would like now to open the questions to the audience. We have exactly 1 minute left, as we are shown discreetly from the first row. Please come forward and don't hesitate. Time is short. There's a question.
Hi. Thank you so much for your precise and articulated account of...
You also keep saying precise. I think there's nothing precise in the kibbutz. The whole point is that it's not really precise, and this is the beauty of it. Okay, sorry.
No, your account is precise.
I learned so much about from your account of the kind of internal organization of the kibbutz elements. I was wondering if you could make a few comments about the instrumentality of kibbutz at a perhaps political and territorial scale at the point where they were invented.
I hope this question will not come. So Galia, it's for you.
I don't know. How much time do we have?
There's no quick answer to it, but maybe.
Yeah, on one leg, as we say in Hebrew. It's about the, I mean to describe the kibbutz.
What? No, this is, I don't know if you want to take it, because if I will take it, it'll be very critical, so it's better you take it. The question of the kibbutz as a larger political and territorial phenomenon, which is it's a totally different discourse. And
well, it's also a matter of interpretation, but it always took roles, I mean, social and political and economical. And I think that since, let's say, the 60s, in many ways, the kibbutz was not conscious of it yet, but somehow it stepped gradually out of history in many ways. And the Shade, I mean, this process took many, many years until we arrived to the situation now. And, during the 90s, it was very popular to criticize firmly the kibbutz because of its failures and because any kind of solidarity seemed a little bit monstrous, like having the children out of their parents and things like that. But I think nowadays there is a new thinking because these tools that I mentioned, I mean, there are possibilities that the kibbutz will take part in all sorts of social... But the question is, will it have energy to do so? Or it will, in a way, obey to the organization of materials, you know, to the society outside. And this is a big question. But it could be a vital force. I don't think now it is very much a vital force in the most crucial issues that we are confronting.
I will give a brief answer nevertheless. Certainly, yes. Certainly there is an undeniable paradox, which is formative maybe of the entire Zionist ethos, and that is that we see the kibbutz as a Marxist, oftentimes even anarchist, I would say social avant-garde on one hand, and on the other hand, it's certainly part of a patriotic national project, territorial project, above all, which is what Zionism is, and that is what it is. And in this sense, Galia is right, it had a lot of vitality in partaking in this territorial and colonial project, yes. But if you, for me, because I would like this somehow to have a positive note for once, for me, kibbutz is an interesting, again, is an interesting case study because we architects or thinkers of architecture, we really miss this kind of heroic, or you could call it experimental period of such a spatial and architectural inventiveness. We don't produce so much new forms, really new forms of spaces, forms that somehow translate thinking or ideology into objects and spaces. We don't see it so much. And in this sense, in this respect, and again, also this entirety of the relationship between the professional architects and the what we call the amateurs, is so profound and so interdependent that I think we should all long for this, in this sense, no?
I think we could see this also in other architectures, not just in the territorial project of Israel. If we looked more closely, we would see architecture as a promoter of territorial projects elsewhere, and it would be good to be more self-critical, of course, as architects generally of our role. Thank you very much, Galia and Zvi. Thank you. So, time is short, we learned, and since yesterday we ran a little bit late, today we want to avoid this. I hope that our next speaker is already approaching. I'm not seeing him yet, but there he is. We will now, and this is, let's say, thematically related to what we just listened to with Galia and Zvi. We will now have a talk by Delphine Sardo from Portugal, on the question, what can architecture do in a revolution? Stories from a pragmatical utopia. And we are more precisely going back to the 1970s, to 1974 to 1976, when the Saal movement, the Saal, the mobile service assistance was founded to create a new kind of housing that was not the traditional housing system made by the state, but it was also not the market system, of course, but it would be a housing that would be from bottom up and not from top down. And so the whole idea of this movement that only lasted basically 2 years after the revolution, until the counter-revolution finished this set the stage for a whole new way of building and of thinking about building social housing in Portugal first, but also it had a huge influence on others. We have to acknowledge, or we can acknowledge today, that personalities like Álvaro César Vieira, who have been also very influential for Berlin and the IBA especially, have made their first experiences as Marxist architects who wanted to really create a social revolution through the architecture in that moment. And Delphine Sardo will give us a lecture with photographs and films, both historical and contemporary, both documentary and artistic in scope. And we will be happy to listen to him now. Delphine Sardo is a curator and a writer. He is a professor for curatorial studies and art history at Coimbra University in Portugal. And I would like to welcome together with you Delphine Sardo.